Good morning. So I've been doing, or myself and a bunch of others have been playing with livestock-related questions related to cropping systems. I'm a cropping systems guy at Montana State, and I'm not really sure what qualifies me to be part of this group here today, but I got convinced that I maybe had something to say. So I've got a long list of co-authors. Anton is an economist, Hatfield is a livestock researcher, Manalot is weeds, Walker is a graduate student I just finished up, Ward is a GIS specialist, Kathy Zabinski is an underground rhizosphere ecologist, Emily Glunk is here, another livestock scientist, and then Susan Tallman, it works for NRCS. If the talk goes well, it'll be due to the contributions of these people. If it doesn't, I'll take full blame. So since we've been working in this area, it seems like we've got a number of challenges that have arisen. And these are the five that I'm going to roll through today. I'll let you have a quick read, and then I'm going to move on and take each one of these in turn. So that's kind of my list, and hopefully it'll make sense once I get into each of these. The climate challenge. I had a chance to be part of a working group on climate change in the Missouri River Basin a few years ago, and part of that was a stakeholder meeting with farmers and ranchers to talk about potential to predict decadal scale climate variation in the region. And this was a slide that Vikram Mehta put together. On the top, you've got Missouri River stream flow anomalies. So if it's zero, that's average. If it's above that, it's higher than normal. If it's below that line, it's below normal. And you know, these multi-year swings and patterns is like, wow. As a farmer, as a rancher, how do you deal with that? And this was just converted to the Palmer Drought Severity Index. Well, that's the danger of that mouse. In the same region, and it doesn't exactly line up, but it's pretty close. I mean, so there's some serious climate variation that we've got to deal with when we're thinking about some of these cropping systems on the landscape. This was a slide put up by Chad Lee in that same workshop, and the brown line on top is the cattle herd in that Moriah subbasin from 1998 to 2012. And we had about a five-year drought from about 98, 99 to somewhere 2002, 2003, and you could see the cattle herd. I'm going to take a chance on this mouse again. You can see the cattle herd was trimmed back as a response to that drought. And then it started to rain, and it took a while for guys to believe that, hey, it's actually going to be back like, you know, normal rainfall, and so they built the herd back up. But this, the green line, is the hay yield or the hay availability in that same sub-basin. And when that green line gets far away from that brown line, that's a lot of money for ranchers. If you've got to buy forage in a dry year and a short year, it's not a fun situation. And what I want to say about that is that caption on the bottom. We talked to both farmers and ranchers about this sort of multi-year climate variation. The farmers seemed like they could deal with it. It wasn't that big of a deal. The ranchers really they got it, they understood it. I mean, this year-to-year forage availability is something that they deal with and they live with. And then you look at what's happened with the forage reserve in Montana. This is our CRP acres. Again, you can see this. I'll take a chance on this mouse again. You can see what during this drought cycle, we had an uptick on CRP acres in Montana, leveled out. And then once it started raining and we had good crop prices, CRP's been coming out at a pretty rapid rate. And the reason that's important from a forage perspective is that was always sort of our backup forage reserve in the state. If forage got short, we could open up CRP and for emergency haying. So that's an additional challenge. And this is, visiting with Darren Boss, and actually Darren said, don't worry about it if you mess it up, Perry, I'll just come and fix it up after you here. Cover crops can backfill that shortfall to some extent, and actually that seems to be what's happening with growers in Montana. This is actual data. Took me more time than you'd think to get these bars put together, but this is based on county level crop statistics in Montana over the last 3 years, and anything that I could identify as a cover crop, and you know, just a plow down green manure, some sort of cover crop polyculture, that's that little blue bit on the bottom, no change over the last 3 years. The orange part in the middle, that's all annual forage. So that does include annual cereal hay, but it's about a 46% increase over that from 2014 to 2016, and much of that is associated with cover crops, these cover crop polycultures and mixtures. And then the green bit on top is the grazing. And that's more than doubled in this time frame. And again, that's strongly associated with cover crops. So cover crops are having some impact, and it looks like it's on an upward trend. But that's a long way short of the CRP acres that we've got to backfill. That's all I'm going to say about climate, and you know, we can talk more about that later. I wanted to talk about the next challenge, which is valuing cover crops. It's been a real eye-opener trying to figure out how to value cover crops. And so I'm going to tell you more about this study in a minute, but I just wanted to hit you with one punchline off the start. We've been doing an organic system study where we're looking at grazing to reduce tillage. And as part of that project, Jasmine Westbrook had a master's thesis where she was looking at daily gains in a couple of different, with sheep, on a couple of different treatments, continuous and rotational grazing. And those were the kind of average daily gains she was getting, somewhere around, you know, three or four tenths of a pound per day. And at the price of lamb and the stocking rate that she was using and the length of time period, it was looking like it could be a pretty promising way to add value to that system. And I'm not going to apologize for these U.S. units, because most of these slides were prepared for producers, and I just didn't want to make them over again in metric units. So this was part of her thesis. She came up with an estimate of what the economic benefits of those organic cover crops was. And in this particular case, it was winter pea 1 year and sweet clover another. But you look at the bottom, we had three systems: grazed, organic grazed, and organic tilled, and a conventional no-till system. So we know it costs money to till. It costs money to till those systems during that cover crop phase. It costs money to spray those cover crops out. But in the grazing case, it looked like a lot of money when they converted that average daily gain times the stocking period. Wow. And I thought this was really cool because at other phases in this rotation, and I'm going to show you that rotation here in a second, we were losing about 15 to 20% of our crop yield in this organic graze system. So having a number like this to come in from the grazed cover crop, that was going to really help reset the balance sheet on that system, or so I thought. And so, you know, that was a big moment. And then we got an economist involved. And I love working with economists, but they, you know, they come at things with a level of detail that we don't always think about. Anyways, I better explain the study. So I've already said three cropping systems. That's what's listed there. There's a five-year rotation that's common to all those systems. So safflower underseeded to sweet clover. Sweet clover is a biennial, an obligate biennial. Sweet clover is our cover crop phase in that organic system. Winter wheat, lentil, winter wheat. Three reps, large plots. We did use field scale equipment in there. And the economist did this over a three-year cycle, exclusive just to sweet clover, although it wouldn't have mattered if he'd included the initial winter pea year, too. Here's what the study would look like. Here's the layout, an overview shot with the different systems. There's a close-up, all those little spots there that, you know, with biomass missing, that's where we're busy taking samples and things like that. So, net present value annualized returns. When you see terminology like that, you know you've got somebody who's serious about their economics. There's the three systems, and you look at the organic graze system on the right, and it was losing $146 an acre. This is across the whole five-year rotation now. And it was losing a bunch of money relative to the other two systems. The chem no-till and the organic tillage were very comparable, but we're losing about I wanted to go look at that sweet clover phase because my livestock friends had told me, hey, that's making so much money. But these are all negative numbers. Chem, no-till, organic tills, and organic grazed, they even had a negative number for organic grazed. You know, what's going on? And so he was trying to cost out things like high tensile wire and all the posts for fencing and the labor to move that fence. And I think out of an Iowa State study, had a value of $117 per acre per year for this mobile fencing that we were using. And so it took all the fun out of it in a hurry. So then we're interacting with farmers. Like, how, you know, it seems like farmers don't even think about fencing. I mean, they just assume they have it. But it is, you know, if you're an economist, you want to cost that out. And then you know, how are farmers valuing these cover crop acreages? It seems to be sort of a straight up $20 to $30 per AUM. To keep it simple, that's not a very big number. They don't seem to care as much about quality as they do about quantity, and it's not a very big number. And if you take even I get that fencing number down to $50 an acre, it's going to be a tough situation to find profitability. Well, what about are we improving soil? Are we managing weeds better? Something that we got to think about some of those benefits. This is what if I tear down sweet clover with a disc. This is what it's going to look like. It disturbs the soil pretty well. Here's the grazing system. You can see the sheep way in the background if you look carefully there. They've just been put in there in the middle of June. They've just been taken out here, and we've still got real good soil cover, so I've been doing a nice job. I think we've actually let them come back in and just clip off all the flower buds once more since then. Still looks real nice from a soil quality point of view. And by the time we see the winter wheat that fall, that's something you feel pretty good about. I mean, it's from a soil quality point of view. What the real value of that is, that's going to be harder to quantify, but some satisfaction there. On the weeds, I got to use this pointer again. You'll see this nice green plot here. That had been tilled 2 weeks prior, so it shouldn't have been green. And that was one of two reps in one phase of the organic graze system that looked like that. Coincidentally, both following lentils. And when you get a closer look, it was a pretty strong infestation of creeping thistle, otherwise known as Canada thistle. And when our weeds guys did a survey out there actually was not a square meter in that particular plot that did not have a thistle rosette in it. And we had that in two of three plots in that phase. So that's a big problem. But I don't want to leave, that's a pretty negative note. I wanted to include this slide of an organic field day that I was able to attend near Haver this summer, and they also use sweet clover. It's actually getting to be a gold standard cover crop or legume manure crop for organic systems. And in that particular case, the farmer had grazed off that sweet clover at an earlier stage than we did in our study, and I actually think we're going to adopt his management. And then he let it rebloom and was actually trying to get some seed yield off one part of it, and then you see on the right where he had tilled it under, and he actually happened to be moving his cattle that day. So I think I think there's positives, but we've got some things to sort out. Cover crops. I want to go back to cover crops for a second. What's our dryland experience with covers? I was in this cover crop session yesterday, and I think some of our numbers are probably even worse than some of the things I saw yesterday. Soil impacts on water and nitrogen. What this slide is, it's bushels per acre. Again, a farmer audience that when I present this. On the y-axis, and then just the yield compared to Chem Fallow. So in this was a study where we were just independent observers, or independent measurers or monitors, I guess, because the farmers did everything. They planted the cover crops as advised by NRCS, and we just came in and measured soil water, soil nitrogen, and then subsequent crop yield. And this was the yield compared to Chem Fallow. And it was all negative numbers. Fields 1, 2, and 8 were pretty high rainfall areas, so there wasn't too bad of numbers there, but those fields in the middle were in north central Montana, a little drier area. And, multiply that by each of those numbers by $5 an acre, and then subtract another $40 an acre to cover seeding and seed costs, and, not a good situation. And so could grazing help right that ship a little bit? And so This was a precipitation graphic that Bo Walker put together, and I thought it was useful to think about how this precipitation gradient goes across the Northern Great Plains. So we've got from Bismarck to this area up here in north central Montana is one of the areas that I'm focused on. And if we look at cover crops in Bismarck, they can look like this. This is actually our cover crops at termination up in that area that I just pointed to. So. It makes a pretty stark example of how little biomass we're actually growing in some of these areas. So we've got these cover crops. We could maybe graze them, get some value out of it, but how does that affect soil? That opens up a whole different set of questions. It's supposed to be all about what goes on below ground, but we know that's not true. We know it also matters what goes on above ground. This was from Bo Walker's master's thesis. He just defended two Mondays ago. Potentially mineralizable nitrogen measured at spring wheat planting 10 months after the cover crop. And so we grazed the cover crop off for 24 hours, 10 months prior, and then we wanted to see, what's that next wheat crop see? What are those cover crop effects on that next wheat crop? And significant differences here between the a grazed cover crop treatment and a more conventional brown manure, one that we just sprayed out chemically, where that grazed system didn't look to be, you know, as capable at supplying organic nitrogen. This was at one site where it's a wetter site with higher organic matter, so a bigger difference there. At the North Gallatin Valley site, it was pretty droughty there, and so we didn't get much of a difference there. Looked at a whole bunch of different enzymes, a lot of different things, actually. Most things weren't that different, but here was the acid phosphatase enzyme, and this is now the opposite, where the graze system somehow, again, measured 10 months later, after 24 hours of grazing, we pick up a significant enzyme effect like this. The trend was the same at the other site, but you can see this, there was a lot of variation there because the stats aren't very convincing there. But anyways, this got us asking questions about, you know, what does go on when you graze these cover crops. That's all I'm going to say about it. We did take a lot of other soil measurements, so I'd be happy to visit with you about that. Another part of this Walker thesis was he was asking questions about, sort of from a logistical perspective, if I'm a wheat guy and I'm going to grow a cover crop and I need to engage somebody from the livestock end of things, how does that work out? What's that physical proximity? So this is a map of Montana. The red bits are all, that's wheat acres, pretty much. And then the anything that's not red is pasture, rangeland, those sorts of things. A lot of data to sort through here with this GIS analysis. We used four exemplary counties because it would have been too much to take on the whole state. These are the four counties, and you can see by the underlying wheat production, there's going to be probably some difference on the how crop and livestock interact in each of these counties. Bo simply developed a map where, on this map, all the blue squares, and these are quarter sections, were identified as grazing land. And all the red has grown wheat at least once in the last 5 years, so we know it can grow wheat. And this was just the distance between that wheat land and the grazing land to just say, hey, how far would you have to move cattle to, you know, take advantage of a cover crop in an otherwise cropland scenario? And a county like Fallon County, it looks very doable. This is Fergus County, again, a cooler climate up there, but again, lots of potential for interaction. So I guess the point of this is you wouldn't actually have to be both a farmer and a rancher as long as you could come up with some sort of arrangement with you're a crops guy and you've got a ranching neighbor who might want to interact with you to take advantage of some forage value. And here's Hill County. And so primarily a wheat production county is going to be more challenging in a county like that. But even in Hill County, there's areas that where this could be done. So. This is Stillwater County. It was very similar to Fallon County. The last thing I wanted to do here was talk about challenges with that growers are actually facing when they do cover crops for forage, for grazing, in this part of the world. And so Susan Tallman is a former graduate student of ours. She's now the area agronomist for the Bozeman Area Office. Montana is divided up into four areas that you can see on the left, so she's responsible for that Bozeman area in the lower middle part of the state. And she has a team that looks at soil health aspects. They're called the BASH group, the Bozeman Area Soil Health Group. And they've put out reports the last 2 years from doing pretty detailed surveys with farmers who are using cover crops for grazing. What are growers doing? What kind of challenges are they experiencing? In their survey, 20 cover crop growers in these 2 years, all but one were polycultures. Average number of species was eight. Eight dryland, 12 irrigated farmers in this collection of participants. On the dryland, most were grazed or hayed. A couple were just actually sprayed out as a brown manure. But they did measure the forage yield potential on all of these sites by clipping forage samples prior to termination. On the irrigated side, everybody was grazing. Most were relay crops following winter wheat after a cool season cereal crop hay, like hay barley, or a hailed out crop in a couple of cases where they needed to come back in and see if they could generate some biomass. There's a seed cost. You can see the range and the average there, and those seem to be pretty consistent across the state. But then there was, you read these reports, and there's just a whole bunch of logistical problems. Seed metering problems, too much seed, not enough seed. Seed evenness amongst different species. If things settle out in the tank, they don't get good coverage of different crops evenly across the soil. So residual herbicide damage, taking out dicots in one case. Lack of soil fertility, really limiting the growth of warm season grasses in another case. Volunteer crop interference. I mean, that's actually from a forage point of view, that should be a good thing, right? But if you've got barley or wheat or something coming back, that just provides another bit of forage. But if you've planted or paid for a cover crop, you probably want to see something about that cover crop. Dominance by one or more species. You know, they've got eight species in the mix, but maybe only one actually is making most of that biomass, one or two. So I would say the productivity has been variable, but growers are engaged, and they seem eager for this research, or for research in this realm. I made the mistake of asking Susan, because we want to advance our own research, what questions should we be looking at with this grazed cover crop research? And I don't think it took her 5 minutes to send me an email back with 10 things that we should be studying, and each one of those would be a significant project. So there is need for research. If you look at some productivity metrics, I just got a couple slides to finish up here. This was their measurement based on clipping of animal unit or AUMs per acre. This is the dry land situation. So you can see the seeding dates there across the bottom, going from the 1st of May to through the end of August, and tended to be seeded on the dry land setting, tended to be seeded earlier in the year, and the range in AUMs probably 2 to 4, probably averaging under 3 AUMs per acre as part of that study. And here's the irrigated. So later seeding, like I say, it tend to be mostly relay crops, but spread out all the way into the season. These AUMs probably are underestimated because in a lot of cases they measured or clipped biomass maybe at the time they initially put cattle out, and we know those crops were going to continue to grow at some rate beyond that. So it probably is an underestimate of AUMs here, but certainly much more variation. I would have expected higher numbers overall, but again, because they clipped at sort of the initiation of grazing, I think they probably underestimated some of this. And so from my really limited perspective on integrated crop livestock systems, I would have two conclusions. The grower interest somehow remains strong. We keep analyzing this and coming up with pretty negative looking data, yet the growers are really engaged, and so I think it causes us to take a harder look and figure out why they're really interested in this stuff. And then obviously that begs a broad need for research. And I was hoping to leave some time for questions. So if there is any, I'll try to entertain them.
Thank you, Perry.
Yeah.
There are a couple minutes for questions.
Perry, you mentioned the big difference between the economist assessment and kind of the farmer assessment. You mentioned 50 may be a difference, but kind of real world on the farm, what are the farmers, how do they pencil out the economics of this?
Darren, are you going to talk about that?
A little bit.
Okay, I'm going to...
You can repeat the question.
Yeah, sorry. So the question was, the sort of the full-on economist analysis of what the net profitability of this grazing of a cover crop is versus, sort of the real world of, I've already got the fence, I have high tensile wire that I have kicking around the farm, those sorts of things. That's something that from an economist's point of view is really tough to sort out, because their job is to try and assign costs to everything in that system, and that comes down to, what does the farmer charge or the rancher charge for his labor to get out and move that mobile fence? If you're hiring somebody to do it, I guess it seems like a fair cost, but so I don't have a good answer, Ray. But I know Darren's going to address it a little bit. So, Vern?
One of the issues about growing a crop as a cover crop as part of a whole growing season is that the cover crop really has a limited number of days of grazing.
Mm-hmm.
So to get the infrastructure on that for a limited number of days, you need to have a certain carrying capacity to pay for it.
Very good point. So the question was, one of the issues with these cover crops on sort of an intermittent basis on otherwise crop land is you need to somehow account for or enable yourself to create a grazing structure there for animals, water and fencing primarily. And I know Darren's going to talk about that a little bit too. So But it's a valid point. And I mean, more to that point, then farmers, ranchers are interested in sort of using that timing to spare their native pastures in some very useful way too. And I think there's value there that we don't fully appreciate.
Thank you, Perry.